Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Uli Korch and Jayant Bhandari. Uli is the founder of both the Monetary Trusts Initiative and Global Partners Investments. He has worked in over 50 countries, written a bill for Congress, and conferred with approximately 15 national presidents, ministers of finance, and ministers of commerce. And Jayant has been traveling the world to look for investment opportunities, particularly in the natural resources sector. He advises institutional investors about his finds. He worked for 6 years with U.S. Global Investors in San Antonio, Texas, a boutique natural resource investment firm, and also for 1 year with Casey Research. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, hello, Richard.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Great. Today, we thought we'd steer the discussion in the way of central banks, central bank policy, monetary stimulus, what's happening in terms of interest rates. And I guess to kick off the discussion, Uli, you mentioned there's a general desire to reload ammunition, meaning an increase in interest rates now by central banks to be able to offer stimulation needed during a recession, potentially in the future. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we're going to have another recession. We always do. Who knows when it'll come, but it's going to come. And we've already, I think this is the second largest, we're close to being, or second longest, we're close to having the longest, I think, build up growth since the last recession, since World War II. So we're going to have another recession fairly soon. The problem is that under our current system, which I would be happy to discuss, and I'm not a lot happy with, nonetheless, we use interest rates in order to stimulate the economy. And it appears negative. So what we do is when there's inflation, we increase interest rates, which makes money more expensive. You think, well, that's crazy. That's kind of backwards. Well, it sort of is. But what it does is it stops people from borrowing more money, and it's through debt that we created our money. Our money is made in our economies. And vice versa in the case of a recession. And the interest rates globally, certainly in the OECD, are so extraordinarily low so that's why they call it reloading the ammunition, that in order to stimulate growth during the upcoming recession, whatever that will be, there is not enough movement without going back into negative interest rates. So I would say that if we do have another recession fairly soon, which I wouldn't be surprised at, I think we're going to go into negative interest rates here in the U.S. also, which Janet Yellen relatively recently, let's say 6 months ago, said, yeah, hey, if that's what it takes, that's what we're going to do. We're open to that, which is just terrible policy, and it has not worked well in Europe at all. So that's the reloading process that they are trying to go through.
So do you see an actual going into negative interest rates from a nominal perspective or real terms perspective or both?
Both. We can go on and on about negative interest rates and the terrible effect that they have on savers and the fact that they seem not to work because if you think about it, most of the savers are older, and they're trying to live off a certain portfolio, or let's say corporations are expecting a certain kind of income from the paper that they hold. When you have negative interest rate, the more money you have, the more expensive the money becomes. This is backwards. You know, you do not make money off your money. You lose money off your money. And the net result is, in studies that we are now able to do, because we've now had negative interest rates in quite a number of countries for a longer period of time, we see that in actual fact, consumers, which here in the U.S. is 70% of the GDP, they actually save more. It actually has a negative effect. Instead of negative interest rates stimulating the economy, which is the purpose, they actually slow down even further. So the answer is Yeah, I can see us going there, because we're in a very weird kind of a place. Let me move to, and then we can switch back and forth. I think the image that I see is in aviation, it's what we call a coffin corner. And pardon me, I'll try not to be too technical here. I fly, and I understand this. Quite a number of decades ago, the FAA found out that high-performance airplanes at high altitudes started just falling out of the sky for seemingly no reason whatsoever. And they said, what's going on here? And if you draw a graph where the y-axis is the altitude and the x-axis is the indicated speed, the rate at which the airplane will fall out of the sky, okay, in other words, the stall speed is basically a straight line, straight up and down, because that is the speed that the airplane feels. Indicated airspeed is what it feels. Yeah. And then we have another line that slopes upwards towards the left, and that is the critical Mach number. And as you go higher and higher in altitude, ultimately those two lines intersect. And that tiny little intersection, we call it the coffin corner. Mm. Coffin, because you die. You hit that intersection and you're dead. So the problem is that if you speed up only a little bit, the airplane disintegrates. If you slow down only a little bit, it stalls and falls out of the sky. That's why it's called a coffin corner.
Wow.
The U-2, for instance, this biplane, that, by the way, I think it's the longest serving military plane in the Air Force arsenal. It's been used for over 50 years. It flies within 5 knots of the coffin corner. So you speed that baby up by 2.5 knots, yeah. You're right there. You slow it down. So it's unbelievably tricky. And it took the FAA a long time to figure out, why the heck are these airplanes just falling out of the sky? We are at the same place from a monetary perspective. We have an intersection of the interest rates that the economy and the world, the two are not the same, but they're very, very related, are able to handle. That's basically a sort of a straight line. And then we have the intersection where the central banks are desperately trying to increase that rate, but they can't. Okay. I mean, for instance, this month, February 3rd, I believe it was, the PBOC, the Central Bank of China,
yes,
increased interest rates by the huge amount of 10 bips, you know, 10/100ths of 1% of interest. Really?
Yeah.
Because realize they are in this coffin corner. They're desperate to increase the rates, but if we do, what happens? So several things. Number one, the governments cannot afford their own debt. Okay, if we were to pay normal interest rates on U.S. federal debt right now, we would have a deficit way above $1 trillion because we're saving so much money on the low interest rates. We currently have $10 trillion in global debt denominated in U.S. dollars. As the interest rates go up, those companies, most of them are companies, some of them are individuals, some people took out home mortgages, for instance, in Eastern Europe and stuff like that. Very unwise, unless you're paid in U.S. dollars. They can't afford that either. So if you have a crash internationally, we are so interlinked today, that will come right back into the U.S., into Canada, into Europe. Nobody will be spared. So it's this coffin corner where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You've got to raise the interest rates, but if you do, you crash the economy. What do you do? That's where we're at.
Wow. And Jayant, do you see the same trends as well by different central banks? Do you see them painting themselves into a corner?
Well, what I heard from Uli is very fascinating. Thanks, Uli. It's something very enlightening. Richard, one interesting thing is that if you look at the last one century, Western countries mostly grew at an economic growth rate faster than what the rest of the world grew at the rate of. What actually was happening is that most of the non-Western countries had negative economic a negative real interest rate in the last century. A lot of Western economists don't really recognize that. And my suspicion is that the same disease now might have entered the Western society over the last one decade or so. We might have, in the Western society, repressed businesses so much. We might have overregulated the businesses so much that their capital actually no longer has the capacity to generate economic growth. What Uli was saying about coffin corner, my fear is that even negative interest rates might not be able to help these companies add economic growth to the society. And that's what I'm talking about the Western society. And I think the emerging markets are clearly facing that problem right now, except for East Asia, I think.
Uli, you're going to say something? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I totally agree. I really agree. Absolutely.
And so if this is the case and decreasing rates are not stimulative, as you refer, Uli, an increase in debt is not desired. And also an increase in consumer savings is caused by low interest rates. Could we see a sort of stagflationary environment develop with low growth and rising interest rates, rising inflation?
Yeah, I don't know about the stagflation because we continue to be in such a strongly deflationary environment. The stagnation, yes, absolutely. But it would be more of the Japanese style, which is a deflationary stagnation versus what we saw in the 70s and 80s, which was the stagflation. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the demographic changes that are happening in everywhere, well, almost everywhere except maybe the Middle East, Russia is the worst. China it's about to hit massively 10, 15 years from now. The U.S. is already there. Germany is there. All the OECD countries are there. Plus IT developments, which drastically reduce prices, plus global trade, plus a debt overhang, because the debt overhang, there's so much pressure for central banks to lower the interest rates. You add all those four factors together, and it's strongly deflationary. Am I saying we cannot have inflation? No. I mean, maybe some country goes crazy or something. But the probability of that occurring, I would say, is very low. Let me, on that note, it's interesting, being here in the U.S., the situation is somewhat the same in Canada, not quite as strong. Every single major crash that we've had for over 100 years has been deflationary. And yet, when I talk to people all the time, everybody's afraid of inflation. I'm going, do you ever read history? They're all kind of looking at me. Are you aware of the fact that the Great Depression, the Great Recession, the depression of the 20s or the late 1890s, they were all deflationary. So why are you so hep on insisting we're going to have inflation, where all of our crashes have been deflationary? And you look at Japan right now, they've gone through 25 years of strong deflation and have not been able to get themselves out of it. So what is it that we're so hyped up about inflation about? Anyway, that's...
Jayant?
Well, in my view, Richard, at least as we have been talking about India for the last, in the last couple of sessions that we have had, I think inflation will continue, and the government of India is certainly preparing itself to print a lot of money. What these guys are doing, and I think this is what international organizations are doing with most of the emerging markets, is that they are trying these emerging markets to go cashless so that they can basically destroy informal economy, because informal economy does not generate taxes for the institutions and for the governments, and they don't really care about these people. They want to move this money to the formal economy. And what is happening, I see happening in a lot of these countries in Africa, in Latin America, and in South Asia, is that because they are trying to force people to move their investments from informal to formal economy, they're helping reduce the interest rate of the formal economy, but they're actually destroying the economic growth in the informal economy. And that is where economic growth lies, exists for countries like these. These are poor, rich countries. Now, the result will be, in my view, that there will be inflationary forces in a lot of these emerging markets. However, I would go along with what Uli said about the developed countries.
It is, yeah, especially...
I really agree. And the growth, especially in the developing world, is all on the very, very bottom end of the market. But or and, it really isn't an opposite. Even here in the U.S., the majority of the growth is in new companies. Now, it's not quite at the bottom of the market the way it would be in India, especially, or parts of Africa or Latin America. But nonetheless, it is the growth of small companies that is the biggest spurt that we see here in the U.S. and probably the same in Canada also. And for the first time in decades, I don't have an exact number, but I'd say 50 years anyway, the two lines have crossed negatively, where if you graph the birth of new companies versus the death of new companies, for the first time, we've gone negative. We are now destroying more companies than we are creating. That has never happened before since these statistics were kept. And this is from the Federal Reserve. This is from FRED, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, their data set.
We recently talked to Peter Bukvar, who observes that there's been a lot of Japanese and European investors getting out of global bonds, and there's a potential for a sovereign debt crisis in different countries, governments worldwide. That would be very deflationary, to your point, Uli, on the deflation picture. And would that potentially also result in central banks increasing monetary stimulus at that point, given that there was a very strong deflationary force resulting from these factors? Could we get a lot more QE, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally against it, but yeah, you know, we're so locked into this Keynesian worldview. You know, we call it pushing on a string. You can pull on a string, but you can't push on it. And as we lower interest rates, especially in the negative territory, whether real or nominal, real is bad enough. Nominal gets really terrible. It doesn't work. But we are so locked into this mindset, this paradigm, that that's how we do things. And, Richard, I believe in Fisher. I'm a Fisherian economics. And Chicago plan, and I do not believe that we are good. I believe we're going to see a major crash if we stay with this paradigm. I do not believe there's any way out of it. There is a way out of it, but not within this paradigm.
How do you see it playing out in terms of timeline?
Well, if we keep on doing what we're doing. I don't know. I think we only got a few years. I mean, that's a very short period of time in the great scheme of things. Mm-hmm. If we are willing to switch and walk out of the Keynesian paradigm into the Fisherian paradigm, I think we can solve this.
Giant, your thoughts?
Richard, Keynesian economics has become so much a part of our DNA today that it's almost impossible for our institutions and governments to understand that there's an alternative possible. In their view, printing press is the solution to all the problems. If the economy suffers, they think they can generate wealth through the mechanism of the printing press. And all these emerging markets, again, they have become very big believers in these things. And I completely agree with Uli. In my view, this paradigm will eventually lead to, this has already led to a huge amount of malinvestment in the Western countries. It has likely led to an even higher amount of malinvestments in the emerging markets. In the emerging markets, if you go to Africa and Latin America, private debt levels are actually much higher as a proportion of their GDP than it is in the Western country. So those people have taken out on massive private debts for private consumption, not for investment purposes. And this malinvestment, this debt levels have to get cleaned up. And they are right now simply adding more to these debts and malinvestments right now.
Yes. It sounds like a good Austrian.
Yeah. And so what about the China factor here? Like with the currency losing value and the Chinese central bank trying to bolster the currency, using up a great deal of its reserves already, how is that going to play out? And how could that affect central bank policy in the U.S. and Europe? Yuli?
I only heard part of what you said. I had another call coming in. My apologies. But you're talking about the possibility of a yuan crash or significant change in value. Yeah.
Yeah, and how the Fed and the Central Bank of Europe could react if as China uses more of its currency reserves to bolster the currency, but also if there's an abrupt fall in you know, just from market forces in the yuan.
Yes, there might very well be. I wouldn't be surprised if there is. Under Trump here and where trade is at, it scares me because there's a possibility of another Smoot-Hawley, you know, which was the 1933, I believe it was, act that was passed, which then created a global trade war.
Yes.
Which intensified the Great Depression. Otherwise, I think it would have been fairly easy to get out of it, relatively. I mean, they made a lot of mistakes on the money tightening. And it was also some historical analysis. But one of the major things was the decrease in trade. And I would say that if there's a sudden, which there might very well be, as you say, Richard, just through market forces, decrease in the value of the Chinese yuan relative to the U.S. dollar, because they're not willing to support it. The PBOC is not willing to support it anymore to the level that they're doing now. I saw an article just recently, I'm talking in the last few days, where there was a serious question as to whether the numbers were actually true with what's left on the reserves. Because of the constant drain that's going on, and they're wondering if the Chinese are actually giving us true figures. In other words, the amount of money that is still available to support the yuan is a lot less than what they are officially publishing. That would be even scarier. And I would be afraid then of an immediate strong reaction here from the U.S., you know, through Wilbur Ross, the new Secretary of the Commerce. We would have to be very careful and very wise to then not, you know, immediately do some stupid things as far as blocking trade. The same would be for the rest of the East Asian countries. It would be interesting from an Indian perspective as to what you would think, Jian. Because it wouldn't just be against the U.S. dollar if the yuan has a, you know, a significant crash, let's say 20 or 30%, that's going to affect the whole Asian bloc.
Well, in my view, if yuan falls for any reason, it will be extremely harmful to virtually every emerging market.
Yes.
China is already very competitive compared to, let's say, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Cambodia, a lot of these other smaller manufacturing places. Now, if yuan for any reason falls relative to other currencies, it will be disastrous for these smaller economies. And yuan, but I doubt if yuan will actually fall too much just because of the fact that it's so closely linked to the international businesses and the international market, and it's the production, it's the factory of the world today. So I cannot really contemplate how yuan can operate very differently than how US and Hong Kong dollar operates.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically like a currency board. I mean, that's the PBOC support mechanism essentially creates a currency board. It's not exactly that because it's a sliding scale, but I agree with you. It's they're very similar to the Hong Kong dollar.
And not to mention that it would exacerbate the $10 trillion in U.S. dollar corporate debt internationally if the dollar gets stronger relative to the Chinese currency, making it even more worse on that. And given all these trends, I guess, what are your views in terms of where interest rates are going and how investors can protect themselves? Uli?
Let me just add one more thing to what we're just talking about, and then I'll get to that question. One of the concerns that I have is the push from the Trump administration, Wilbur Ross, especially with respect to the current account, and the fact that they seem to want to create a switch that into a positive situation versus the negative that we've seen. What they don't seem to understand is when the U.S. acts as a global reserve currency, there has to be a constant leakage of dollars out, which gives us a negative current account standing. Because all those countries, those central banks, they have to get dollars from somewhere. And if we were to try to reverse that, there'd be an enormous dollar squeeze globally that would probably backfire like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I, for some reason, they don't seem to get it. I don't understand. Anyway, that's not what you asked.
Oh, no, that's a good insight. And I guess with all these trends, how do you see the interest rates unfolding in the coming months and the potential ways for investors to protect themselves?
Let me give you something really crazy.
okay.
You'd have to have some real balls to do this. And, okay. And it have to be timing involved because I am convinced that they're not going to be able to reload their gun with proper ammunition in time for the next recession. Okay. So here's a play for you. You can, when you think the height of the Fed rate has been reached, you can buy U.S. Treasuries. You could make 100% to 200% over a matter of a few months. You could make an enormous killing. But boy, that's a risky play. That's a risky play. But you could make a lot of money. Anyway, that's one of the things I keep on thinking about. I've been trying to run some graphs, saying, okay, so you know, how do I do this, and what term length and. Wow. And, you know, do I really have the emotional energy? I mean, just saying, I shorted the market, before the last big crash. I went out 4-1 against the market. And ultimately, I couldn't hold it emotionally. So that's a problem with some of these plays where, what's your emotional life worth versus your financial life?
Yeah.
As you probably seen in the movie, the Big Short. Man, that's what, they went out 4-1. That's what I did the same thing. I went out.
Okay. Yeah. I see.
And except they held, and I didn't. I walked out. I finally several months before the total crash came, I said, I can't handle this. This is stupid. I refuse to be the kind of basket case that you saw in the movies. I mean, those guys are all seeing their shrinks and they're getting divorces, and I mean they're a personalized disaster. And I said to myself, I'm not going to be that kind of a person, period, full stop. And I walked out. I cleared all my positions.
Wow. wow. And Jayant, your thoughts, sir?
Well, just to add, Richard, I think, and I'm mostly going to say something about the emerging markets. International institutions have recognized pretty much that a lot of these corporations in the developing world in South Latin America, in South Asia and Africa, don't really produce as much as they thought they should, despite very low labor costs in these countries. And the result has been that these corporations are basically extensions of governments in these countries. There has been a pressure on governments to reduce interest rates for these corporations so that they can survive. And I was saying earlier, the international organizations and these four countries, they are forcing investments to shift from informal economy to the formal economy, which actually is leading to drop in interest rates, which is good for the governments, the tax authorities, and the corporations. But I'm extremely afraid of the future of the poor people in these countries, because the way they want to structure the monetary system of these countries, they might be destroying the informal economies, and they might be destroying livelihoods of a major part of their population, populations that actually don't count, but they are still human beings.
Great insight. And gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work? Uli?
For me, you can just go to ulikorch.com. And other than my latest articles that come out there, I'll hopefully get them up pretty soon, that shows the videos and the corporate and the various things that I am involved in. So ulikorch, ulikorch.com. So.
Great. Thank you. And Jayant?
Well, everything, Richard, I do is on my website, which is jayantbhandari.com.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your great insight.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.